I think that one of the things that amazes me, and we'll talk about it in the course of the hour we have, is the fact that you are able to modulate so beautifully the volume of the acting and the volume of the films. It goes. I wish we had shown the clips, which I saw. Because you adapt so beautifully, I think that there is a single desire in making a movie, which is telling a story. And you and Bill Condon particularly have this beautiful partnership. And you are able to create these beautiful, delicate confections of these characters.
Hello. Well, bubba. Because actors are meant to be heard, aren't they? But is this a joke?
No. There you go.
I can't believe I'm on the same stage as Guillermo.
I don't know how we hit on the same
stage. And I hope one day to be on a film stage with him. Wouldn't that be fun? Anyway. You couldn't have sent anything sweeter to my ears than to say, use the word delicate, because when I started acting in the theatre, I was often playing in very large theatres, I mean, twice the size of this. And the responsibility of the actor, of course, is to tell the story not just to the people who are close by, but to the people at the back and the people up there in the gods. And so my acting was of a rather grand nature, which used to alarm the critics sitting down here. But I hope it pleased the people who hadn't paid very much money sitting at the top. And it wasn't until well into my career as an actor that I did a production of Macbeth with Judi Dench, who's Lady Macbeth, for the Royal Shakespeare Company, and we did that in a theatre that only had an audience of 100 people. So for the first time in my life, I was speaking Shakespeare as quietly as this. And when you say tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, just speaking it and the audience can hear it, it's really working. And that really gave me encouragement that at last I might be able to be in front of a camera without being one of those actors, but theatre actors, people who shout in the evening, isn't it? That's what they're called. So delicacy is something that is hard won for me. But I'm glad that you picked up on it and approve of it.
Well, I think that what we're going to see tonight and what you did with Bill before with Gods and Monsters, which I cherish and adore because, you know, I'm a huge James Whale groupie.
I know, yeah. I know. You know I've got a painting by James Whale.
I know, yes. And I'm going to get in the
day. No problem.
You gave me a brush.
I did. I got James Whale's actual cigar box, isn't it? And it's full of his actual brushes and his travelling easel. So Guillermo, has one of these brushes. That's not the only thing you've got in your man cave. Where did you put it in your man cave?
Oh, it's framed.
Framed? It's not.
It's framed. It's next to a cartoon that James Whale did of an actor.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. I was going to talk about him a lot, but, you know, I think that the beauty of what you're going to see today in every respect is that a lot of people, when we think of style, I think that style in movie making, you can write in caps or you can write in cursive. You can be discreet and have a certain modesty about the style that actually makes the audience sort of grown, lean in and listen more carefully. And that's the type of craft we see today. And we will not do spoilers, but the beauty of tonight is that you're going to see what is an intimate partnership from every department into telling the same story. And I want to talk briefly about two of the departments that partnered with you in this beautiful movie.
Okay.
Makeup and wardrobe.
Oh, yeah.
Dave Elsie and Lou, you know, but if you would talk a little bit about, because their decisions, I always say wardrobe is not a wardrobe decision, it's a storytelling decision. Mm. And we see it beautifully here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the decisions you make on the wardrobe and Bill makes with the wardrobe ultimately tell the same story that you're going to give credence with your body and your language and your voice. Can you talk about those partnerships a little bit?
Yes. I've always been very, very interested in what I wear. Not in real life, but but clothes tell you an awful lot about a person, don't they? You very rarely, it's odd to me, you very rarely see someone in the street or on the subway, and, not that you do either of those things in LA, okay? But you rarely see somebody who seems to be wearing the wrong clothes. They always seem to be dressed exactly as you would have dressed them. Their hair goes with their hoodie, and then their sneakers go with their jeans, if they're dressing down. And so it's very, very important what you wear as a character, because it can give an immediate impact. And even if the man's inside is not like his outside, that will be a voyage of discovery for the audience. But our costumes for this came from a wonderful costume house called Cosprop. You probably know them. And all the clothes that they have in hire there are original clothes going way back to the beginning of the 20th century. And any clothes that are not genuine have been made in absolutely the style of
with the patterns.
With the patterns and everything, and the buttons are sewn on. And once you put those clothes on, you're not wearing a costume, you're wearing your character. So I can't remember the process of going through actually finding the clothes. I know for the old homes, and you'll soon discover that I played two homes in the film, a younger one and an old one. But the old one, we obviously, the clothes were made to be a little bit too big for me, so that my body appeared to shrink in size. What a help that was. And genuinely. And then come to makeup. I remember when we first did Lord of the Rings, and I was out there in...
Did you guys see that one?
Well, we've got to talk about the Hobbit today, but anyway. So there were 2 days put aside for Gandalf's makeup. And we began, and I was appalled, with a beard, which went from here to the ground. Because that seems to be what Tolkien describes. He also describes the eyebrows of Gandalf reaching beyond the brim of his hat. Well, we knew we weren't going to do that in the movie, but over a day and a half, Peter Jackson here and Peter, who was doing the wig there and makeup, kept painting stuff on my face and removing moustaches, and a series of hirsute gentlemen stared out at me from the mirror. Ben Gunn from Treasure Island, alarmingly at one point, Osama bin Laden. until they cut it and shaped it and whatnot, and suddenly they said, "Look at that." And I looked up, and there was a credible Gandalf. And my work was done. Because before they discovered DNA, I think actors knew about DNA. If you get one thing right, if a director says to you, that line was absolutely the character, or that gesture,
yes.
Go or, back. That, or that passion, you say, oh, I see, yes, and I remember what it felt like, and I can go back to that feeling and spread it from the gesture to the thought to the expression, to the way you walk. And it was like that when I saw the face. I suddenly started twitching, my voice was a little bit rougher. Oh, hello, Gandalf. And so it was exactly the same with the older homes.
Yes.
Dave Elsie, what a remarkable man. Now, have you worked with him?
I've admired him and know him, and you know, we've been on the edge of working together. Yeah. I have exchanged many flattering emails,
yeah.
But and we have shared meals at very dubious restaurants. But I consider him one of the current masters of makeup.
Well, we were very, very lucky on a small independent movie where, you know, what independent means is cheap. You can't afford to get the best necessarily unless the best really want to come to you. Thank goodness for us, Dave Elsie is crazy about Sherlock Holmes. He adores everything about it, and the idea of doing the makeup for Sherlock Holmes was a dream come true for him. And what he simply did was paint this rubberized solution on my face and pulled it like that and let it dry, which is almost instantaneous. And then you released it, and there were the wrinkles. It's a sort of reverse of a facelift. Well, there it was. And that only took him 40 minutes to do. He gave me an aquiline nose, which seemed to my nose is rather bulbous, so he made it look thinner. Oh, and then he said, Ian, your hair's got to go back for the old man. So I had to shave here, which I didn't enjoy doing at all. And then he just streaked my hair back, and you know, and after 40 minutes there, it was Holmes looking at me. And it looked so old, so believable, that, you know, as with Gandalf, my body began to respond, and I felt frail and at the end of something.
I think I remember Laurence Olivier said about rain, which he would have, and I think he said the same about makeup, but he said once, very memorably for me, he said when in a rain scene, let the rain do the acting for you. You know, because he knew that there was a power on the screen.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, I can tell you another story about another great actor, Paul Scofield. Now Paul Scofield was great. Theatre actor, but he did win the Oscar for
Man for All Seasons.
And shortly
but
after
for
that,
what? But for Wales.
But for Wales. And he did a film shortly after, I think it was called The Train, John Frankenheimer.
Oh, yeah. Written by Walter Bernstein.
Yeah, and Paul was playing a Nazi officer, and in one scene he was standing in front of the train.
Now, amazing movie, by the way.
Yeah. All Paul's experience of playing theatres, large theatres with enchanting audiences. He did the scene, and then Frankenheimer said cut, and then he went up to Paul and said, Paul, you don't have to act the train. Which is the same thing. You don't have to act the
train. The train,
The train was actually there. In a theatre, it probably wouldn't be there, so you do have to act.
But I think that what we're going to see, I mean, there is... And I do want to talk about the process that led you to the construction of this. It's interesting to me that you play two very different men, different ages too, but men that were in a twilight in both of Bale's movies, James Whale and this. And the parts, and again, I lament the goddamn 30, I'm about to curse. That 13-minute reel that we were going to see had a piece of Gods and Monsters. I hope it stays fresh in the audience's mind.
Maybe you'll put it on. No,
eventually, maybe. Yeah. But what it does is Whale, even although both characters are dealing with the labyrinths of their mind, both characters are kind of getting lost in the labyrinths of their mind, Whale's approach has a certain arrogance and a certain, I wouldn't say entitlement, but he's really trying to remain presentable.
That's right.
Whereas Holmes has this abandon.
That's right.
And I think that's beautiful. Those decisions are your decisions.
When the real James Whale drowned himself, he left a note.
Yes.
And he said to people, don't worry, I'm sorry. And he said, I've had a good life. And that was the point. He'd had a wonderful life. I mean, maybe that was the word, wonderful. He'd come over to Hollywood. He became the greatest, the most, the highest paid director in Hollywood. He was openly gay in the 1930s. You could count people on one hand who were that in the 1930s, anywhere in the world. He was his own man. He made his own sorts of movies with his own, he loved being surrounded by the same people all the time. But now he's got an illness which doesn't allow him to be in charge anymore of himself or his work. He can't paint properly, which he loved to do. He can't think properly, and so he can't imagine life like that. And so he entered. Holmes is, in a sense, when we first meet him, dead inside and dying outside. He has not had a life that he's enjoyed, really, for 30 years since he gave up. He retired from being a detective and living with bees, whose company he enjoys, and the housekeeper, whose company he doesn't particularly enjoy. So, in that state of decrepitude and loss, really, and unhappiness, you can see it, he's so grumpy, isn't he? He makes a discovery about his past, and with the help of other people, discovers what that past was, and you just sense the heart is beginning to beat. As James Whale's heart was stopping. Holmes is coming back to life at 93.
And the beauty, and this will contain no spoilers, don't worry, but I still think it's a journey worth tracking. I think that you show Holmes at three different stages of his life. I think you do an amazing, amazing job at deciding everything in the posture, the gait, the cadence, the rhythms and the volume, all the tools that you have at your disposal are put to work into tracking Holmes in his most, at his peak, yeah, and before his downfall, yeah, during his able years, we shall say, and the decadence. And I think that we see all those tools telling that story. But I wonder if those choices are done, when do you make them? When you first receive the screenplay in collaboration with the director, those choices are found on the day.
Now, do you rehearse your movies?
Yes.
So few directors do. Of course, and they do an enormous amount of work and in advance, and they know what they want of their actors, and they can say it sometimes quite clearly, but the actor hasn't had that preparation. And so what do I do? Well, I read the script and read the script and read the script and note the script and call up Bill Condon and say, am I on the right lines, and so on and so on. But it's self-evident that there is a contrast between the Holmes that we meet at the end of his life and the flashback to the Holmes in his prime. Well, that's a joy for any actor, isn't it, it's rather cheeky to really play two parts of the same.
But you calibrated perfectly. The first appearance of him at his peak is almost shocking because the contrast is so strong. The way you, I mean, I think that there's two choices for an actor or two types of actor. The ones that imitate, and the other one inhabits. And I think the way you inhabit him in the old age is so total, so complete, that when he appears at his prime, it's almost, yes, a jolt.
Yes, good. It's alarming how like John Gielgud I look as the younger. Nothing wrong in looking like John Gielgud, one of the heroes, great actor. But that was Dave Elsie again. I think I wear more makeup, age 75 at the time, to look 60 than I did to look 93. But he cleared up my complexion. And I won't go into it because you'll start looking for him, and it's better if you don't. Let it look as if I'm doing all the work, but I'm not. Dave Elsie would absolutely do that. Yes. But, you know, that's the storytelling. It was quite clear what I had to do. I had to be sprightly, mind alert, a selfish person, a self-possessed person, a confident person, all those things that he's not when he's alone now. And it's the beauty of the way the story is told that the juxtaposition is achieved. But that's not I can't take responsibility for that. That's Bill and his editor.
I would agree in that it's a partnership, but if you don't deliver the goods, the truck is empty.
Yes.
You know, you don't deliver it.
Yes.
I think that The truck may be the director's, not the good finder's. I think that it's if that partnership doesn't work, but the beauty of the character of Holmes, and I think that you are, there is such a meta, when you have a character like that, there are characters that people know without ever having read the books that originated them. Tarzan, Sherlock Holmes, Dracula, the creature of Frankenstein. You know, these are in the vernacular.
Jesus.
Absolutely. If you read the Bible, you'll find
you get a chocolate.
Other than the sandals, a lot of differences. But I think that the then you have the, of course, it's very well known that the appearance of Holmes with the deerstalker hand and all that was the fantasy of an illustrator and so forth.
Yes.
But this is a character that has to take the decision to live, first of all, he has a begrudging attachment to that character. And he doesn't quite understand the legacy of that character. And I think, without spoiling anything, you have a man that has been governed by logic and decides to give in to the heart.
That's
and
right.
To be vulnerable, that's and to be
story. Strong. That's the story.
And that journey, I think, again, for me, how much were you familiar with the actual Holmes books and all the stories and the background of it?
Well, Gabe, I can't remember a time I didn't know who Sherlock Holmes was. I mean, it was rather like Santa Claus to me. It's always been that. There are people, of course, who think that Sherlock Holmes actually existed. There's a bronze statue of him in Baker Street in London, and, you know, as there are statues of other real people around the city. But no, he was not a real person. And of course, the conceit of this film is that he was. So we're not dealing with a fiction. I've lost track.
Well, no,
because you were...
If you have read...
So I did read the stories, and of course they're very easy to read, and that's why they appeal to young people, perhaps. They're short stories, on the whole, most of them. But I enjoyed Sherlock Holmes, and not so much in the books as when I saw an actor impersonating him.
Yes.
And I've seen many of them. There have been 130 of us. There's a little bit of, I don't know if you've ever seen it, a little snippet of the first Sherlock Holmes movie, I think, made in Hungary.
Yes.
Yeah, am I right?
Hungary, yes.
And it's just a tiny little bit, and it's got a bit of film magic in it because he disappears. But nobody knows the name of that man. I sent out that challenge. I'll spend an evening with anyone who can tell me what that man's name was. Nobody knows. But I'd seen wonderful Sherlock on stage. John Wood, a wonderful English actor, played. Keith Michelle, Australian actor, played him on stage. And they were dealing with the William Gillette script, now the American actor who first popularized Holmes, although it's a bit of it on the film, it was on stage. And, well, you immediately understand Holmes, don't you? You know he's a bit autistic. You know that he's a sociopath, doesn't get on with people.
Near the spectrum.
Introspective, totally. And any drug taking or violin playing or rude remarks about people, you know exactly the type he is. Then, of course, he works his wizardry. You almost forget it, but I wouldn't want to spend a day with the show. But there was no point me going back to look at other Sherlock Holmes' performances to get some comfort that I'd got it right, because our script was something other than all those Conan Doyle.
Did any of the performances inform the Holmes that he speak? Because
the way he speaks.
No, his character, his speak here.
Oh, as he speaks, sorry. No, I think it was just my sense of what Sherlock Holmes has picked up over the years, having seen various representations of him. Pictures, cartoons, films, television in particular. I mean, Jeremy Brett in the Granada television series of Sherlock Holmes about 30 years ago to my mind, was absolutely astounding. He presented a very, very troubled man with a dark attitude to life, and only occasionally springing into a sort of brilliance that you could enjoy. It was a very disturbing performance indeed. And that didn't seem appropriate for what we were doing. I think I just had to be energetic in Sherlock Holmes' way. I think I can't put it any clearer than that. But, you know, I'm afraid it comes rather easy to me to play someone as selfish as Sherlock Holmes. And as for the old Sherlock, you know, anyone here alive knows that every day there are intimations of mortality, your own mortality. Your friends get ill, they die. Your parents are long gone. My stepmother lived until she was 100. But towards the end, frail and having to live with constant care, was railed against the fact she was still alive. She couldn't understand it. And I thought, what can you say to someone? Her friends, her sisters had died, and I was about the only close friend she had, and I couldn't always be there. And I said, well, Dad, you give us all heart, you give us all hope that we're going to be as feisty as you still are at your age, when she smiled brightly at that. And, but the misery of losing control, of forgetting things, stumbling.
Especially for a character that was his sharpest tool.
Absolutely.
Is the betrayal from the aspect of his home that he least expects.
Absolutely. No, the story of Eden has been a tragedy, but a tragic bit, isn't it?
No, the thing is, I feel that in both stories that you've done with Bill, you've also had a curious partnership with, like, sort of a fresher mind. In the case of Gods and Monsters, it's Brendan Fraser, and here is the kid, without spoiling anything, but there is a beauty to that, there is a symmetry to that in your collaborations with Bill, where it's almost a rite of renewal, and a rite of courage, because both characters want to end his days, and the other one to allow life into his life, into his daily routine, and the unexpected, and the not planned. But they only gain access to the other person. And I wonder, in both cases, you have actors that are very dissimilar to you. And these partnerships, to me, are very intriguing.
Well, it's one of the great joys about being an actor, wherever you work, that you work with people of different ages. And when I was a kid, I loved working with older actors. It's so many stories to tell you. I mean, and they gave you respect, which you hadn't earned. But they wanted to work well with you, so, you know, friendship was on the table for them. That's why actors call each other darling, you know, we're clinging together. But now I'm at the other end. It's an absolute joy to work with younger people. And so it was easy for me to imagine that James Ware would be like to be in the company of attractive young men, and that the old man without a family, Sherlock Holmes, should eventually be charmed by a 10-year-old, 11-year-old who seemed to have a share in the wit and
the curiosity.
And the curiosity, yes, exactly, of the old man. So that both relationships ring true.
And both actors, I mean, working with Fraser is really, is ultimately a child, his character.
A child.
A child, a very innocent
yes.
character. And
yes.
In both cases, you're also under the gaze of suspicion. Like, everybody scrutinizes that friendship with great suspicion. In the case of Gods and Monsters, of course, a wonderful maid, delightful, but in here is Laura Linney. And that partnership struck me as something you seem to enjoy very much.
Yes, I did. I loved working with Brendan. He was just breaking out as a star, and we were very lucky to have him in the film. But we did a bit of preparation ourselves and talked over the scenes, and I found a congenial spirit there. With Milo, who plays Roger, it was only his second film. Everyone's rather nervous on the film set, of course. Hopefully we've got enough time to do it properly. Didn't cross Milo's mind that there was anything wrong in doing a complicated scene in a morning. That innocence and that freshness and confidence, really, was very helpful, because that was all part of the character he was playing. But Laura, well, you're with someone who knows exactly what she's doing. And her method, it seems to me, although she denies that she has one, is to do a great deal of preparation in advance, which I try to do too. So she arrives on the set knowing every word, could speak it backwards if necessary, and a lot of actors don't do that, but no, she, like me, honors the text, absolutely. She knows it, she knows what she could do with the scene, and if necessary will. And that's what we'll get on the first take, or the little rehearsal. And then she forgets it all. Let's fly.
In a beautiful way.
Responds. And you're not acting with somebody, you're playing jazz.
Because ultimately, all your decisions that are intellectually in pre-production become instinctive during production. And you may assume you're going to use a certain color, and then when the other actor gives you a different note, rather than trying to manipulate, you simply respond.
Well, I try to do that on the stage, and if you're working with right-minded actors, it's absolutely fine. If you're coming against somebody who prides himself on giving exactly the same performance every night, it's rather tricky. But on the whole, the actors I work with, I explain my method, which is, look, we are going to be improvising a bit in front of an audience so that the performance they get will be unique. We won't be doing it tomorrow night, we didn't do it last night, but basically it's the same, but there will be details which are free, and that will keep us interested and keep the audience alert. But of course, with the camera, you're thinking these thoughts and speaking for the first time. That must be the illusion.
That must be.
And
every take.
Well, every take, absolutely, every take. So, I like it, and Bill does it sometimes, and I bet you do it a lot. Invite the actor to do something different on the next take. Ian Hogue, you know, who played Bilbo in Lord of the Rings, I'm in awe of Ian. Sir Ian, but there were two Sir Ians. he deserved his. But we had a scene together where at the beginning of the film, and he said to me, look, he said, I will be doing it different every take. He said, sometimes wildly different. I don't know what will happen, but it'll be slow sometimes, it'll be loud sometimes, it'll be... I'll be laughing, or I'll be crying, and I don't know what I'll do. I may bang against the wall, but... well, that's bliss, because you don't know quite what's coming next, you know what the line's going to be, but you're fascinated by the person, as Gandalf would be in real life. And he says, so I don't give a performance, but I present every aspect of the character that I can think of and convincingly play. And then, he said, I let the director put the performance together and choose. I don't think I'm quite as brave as that, or modest as that.
Let me ask you, your career is, I mean, it's a thing of beauty, not only in the way you interacted with some of the absolute legends of film ever in theater. But was there a moment for you, because I know for a lot of the audience that are not geeks, that I'm talking about the key. For a lot of the audience, you came alive with Richard III. It was the time when everyone, I think that's, your career is one of the most beautifully structured careers. Not that you planned it, but it's...
Tell me,
your early days to the moment where you felt you were popping, you were really commanding your craft.
Looking back at the evidence of performances which remain on videotape and film, I don't think I was a very good actor for a decade or two. Really? No. I don't know what people saw in me. Actually, I think the thing was I was quite good looking. If you are, it's an awful, wonderful help, you know, because people...
I suffer through it.
But from the minute I started, when I said I planned my career, no, you can't altogether. But I did say to myself, I'm not going to take a job unless it's a challenge, unless I feel at the end of it I would be a better actor as a result. I won't be concerned with how much I'm being paid, and I won't much care where it is. In London, out of London, that doesn't matter. So I did about 100 plays before I ever got to London. And found out what I was good at and what I wasn't good at, and I tried to work what I wasn't good at.
You're telling me that we're almost out of time. I say, what the fuck, right?
They've got a film to see.
Well, yeah.
We love you.
There you go.
A couple more questions and then you can start your goddamn film. Please continue. Pray continue.
Film, I just didn't... I just marvel at film actors. And I didn't think, I never expected that I would be allowed to be one of them. Spencer Tracy. How does he do it? Brando knocking the hell out of you. How does he do that? He's so believably real, but so big in his performance. So it was just a wonderment to me. The big breakthrough for me was playing Richard III on film, a part I played a lot in the theatre, and I helped to fashion the screenplay and produce it. And that was a sort of calling card for the film industry. Oh, this guy isn't just a theatre actor. But the big step up for me was that production of Macbeth when I realized that...
You could scale it down.
I could scale it down.
Yeah. But Richard III, there is that beautiful choice which I was hoping we'd see when you're delivering the This is the Winter of a Discontent speech, and in the middle of it, right when he needs to say, to have the introspection about himself,
right,
he goes to take a piss.
Yes.
Was that your idea to break it like that?
Yes. I was very particular as the guardian of Shakespeare, who doesn't fit naturally on the cinema screen. Television screen, yeah, actually, because a lot of soliloquies in Shakespeare, where the characters talk directly to the audience, well, we're very used to that on TV, but film, not so much so. At the beginning of the film, there's about 10 minutes and nobody speaks. Somebody sings, but nobody speaks. When you first see Richard, he's got a gas mask on and he's coming in as a warrior and he's... you hear his breath. Well, actually, that breath is in the iambic pentameter meter. If music be eating the food and I'm like, oh. So I'm getting the audience ready for the black first line. And then the director said, surely we should start the first scene early. And I said, no, we want this audience to say, when is somebody going to speak? Because most people go to a Shakespeare film thinking, oh God, they're going to speak all the way through. So we sort of, I hope, got them. But then I knew from that in that first speech, that in the middle, as you said, it's clearly a public speech, and then it becomes an inside speech. So I said to Richard Longkin, the director, where is the most private place that this person could go to speak to himself? Yeah. Or look in the mirror and speak to the camera? And we said, oh, would you think of this?
Well, since they are pressing us for this, may I say in the absolute sincerity that you guys that haven't seen it, and those of you that are going to see it again, you are going to witness one of the most delicate, beautiful performances of the year, and one that I urge everyone to remember at this time of giving.